Hello and welcome to the third episode of the Confluence Mailbag Podcast. I'm Bill O'Grady, Advisory Director at Confluence Investment Management. Joining me today, as always, is Mark Keller, CEO and CIO of Confluence. We're recording this podcast on September 30th. The idea behind this podcast is to replicate the question and answer sessions from the old A.G. Edwards Investment Strategy Committee's open mic sessions from earlier in this century. If you'd like to submit a question, email us at mailbag@confluenceim.com. Each month, we select 4 to 5 of the most common, provocative, and interesting questions you receive, and Mark and I will address them. So without further ado, let's tackle the first one. The first one, how does the dollar affect the allocation between international and domestic equities, and do you think the recent dollar weakness has legs? Well, I will start on that one. There's a chart that we publish, goes back to 1970, and it's delineated by dollar bull and bear cycles. And the difference in performance between the U.S. and developed markets and emerging markets is pretty clear cut. If you look at like the period between 1985 to 1995, which was the big post-Plaza Accord bear market in the dollar. The S&P was up about 11.2%, EAFE was up 15%, and emerging markets were up 23%. The subsequent bull market between 1995 to 2002, the U.S. is up 13.3%, EAFE was up a modest 2.2%, of course this is for all dollar-based investors, and EM was down 3.3%. We had a dollar bear market from 2002 to 2011. In that period, the U.S. averaged 4.3%, EAFE 8.4%, and EM 17.6%. And then the dollar bull market that began in May of 2011, been well documented that the U.S. has had exceptional performance, up 13.7%, EAFE up 5.7%, and EM up modest 2.3%. Dollar does drive the returns for a dollar-based investor, and pretty much the whole underlying basis of it is if you're denominating your returns in dollars and the dollar's appreciating, it's to your benefit. When the dollar's depreciating, it's not. But there are other factors involved too. I do know that dollar behavior will affect earnings of domestic U.S. domestic companies. Isn't that a fact?
Yep. There's no doubt. As the dollar gets weaker, the competitive position of American manufacturers improves vis-a-vis foreign. And you can have, I was just listening to a speaker at a conference I was listening to this morning, said you can have a good economy with a bad currency. That was the line he used. I thought it was great because, there's a lot of manufacturers in the U.S. who would love a weaker dollar. This has been tough for them to compete against foreigns. And those are often, in the stock market, those are often the stocks that are relatively inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got two things, going for foreign stocks, though. One is the weak dollar, as you point out, and I think you and I are both in the camp that it indeed does. This dollar bear market looks to me like it does have legs because the policies the current administration put in place seem to me to be dollar bearish. And the last administration, did some things to Russia, notably freezing their foreign reserves, which is about as dollar bearish of an action as you can get. So I don't see a lot of policies from either side of the aisle over the next 5+ years that strike me as being dollar bullish. So I think that is good news for foreign equities. Also, they're frankly cheaper. They're kind of they're not dirt cheap. They're not like bottom or recession cheap, but they're kind of normal valuations. Whereas you look at the major indices in the U.S., they're pretty rich. Valuations are, depending how you measure it, either at or very close to all-time high valuations. Now, let's not be black and white and say there's nothing positive for U.S. stocks. No, far from it. We just talked about one. Weak dollar is good for manufacturing. Also, valuations, that valuation I just described, it's bifurcated. The AI trade seems to be transitioning into a bubble to me, has a lot of expensive stocks in it. And a lot of companies have just been left behind. Their valuations just aren't that great. So we have kind of a bifurcated stock market from a valuation point of view, which reminds me a lot of 25 years ago in the late 90s. And we had a bear market when the internet stocks all fell apart in 2000, 2001. But frankly, an awful lot of stocks did quite well because they'd been left behind. So I think the story, and we've been saying this consistently this year, the story we think long-term for U.S. stocks is somewhat mixed, depending on which side of the AI trade you might be on. But the outlook for foreign stocks looks pretty good.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. If you look at any of the requisite dollar index charts, it's pretty obvious that the cycles tend to go for a pretty long time. 5 to 7 years is actually a short cycle for the exchange rate. So if we're right, and this is the beginning of a dollar bear market, we're probably in the very, very early stages of it. Another way to think about it is from a policy perspective, is that I think the Trump administration has started off its trade policy activity by focusing on tariffs, but I do think the next phase will be then to go and look at currencies as well. And we've seen a little bit of that with Switzerland, the recent news on that. The Swiss actually intervene in their currency markets a lot, but it has nothing to do with its relations with the U.S. It had everything to do with its relations with the EU, and we won't go down that rabbit hole. But the U.S. and Switzerland have come to some sort of an agreement on how Switzerland will manage its exchange rate. I think that we're going to see a lot more of that going forward, and I think the drive is going to be for adjusting the dollar lower. So that's the other element of this. There's usually a policy element that drives these exchange rates as well.
From a sentiment point of view, U.S. investors, both institutional and retail, are terrifically underinvested overseas. I mean, it's hard to find anyone who even has what used to be considered a normal overseas exposure of 15 to 20%. I mean, it seems to me the whole U.S. Investment community is 0 to 5%.
If that.
Yeah, if that. So does this change our allocation? Yes. Mm-hmm. It means one should have some allocation there. Doesn't mean, you flip it. I think dollar-based investors should have the majority of their investments in dollar-based securities. But zero is too little of an allocation. And I think that's where we just have to start. I think investors should be increasing that allocation. I think at least into the 5 to 10% range. And a well-diversified investor, they could even go above that.
Yeah, we'll close on this one with one other observation is that as U.S. investors have underinvested overseas, overseas investors have overinvested in the United States. So one podcast I listened to a couple months ago was discussing how Europe's going to pay for all this defense spending it's going to need to do. And he said, well, they're probably going to sell U.S. equities to raise the funds. So, yeah, I think this is the beginning of a long downward move in the dollar. Now, again, doesn't mean you won't have countercyclical rallies, but I think the overall trend longer term is down. Question number two. Do we see a recession anytime soon? Actually, no. At least I don't. Not nationally. I do think we have pockets of the economy that have been in recession. I think the bottom 60% of households in terms of income are experiencing near recession-like conditions. I think the housing industry has been in recession for a bit. There's probably some sections of the country regionally that are experiencing weakness. But, if you look at the GDP Now numbers from the Atlanta Fed, they're looking at a solid, I think it's close to 4% real growth for the third quarter. So there's no obvious recession out there. Now, it doesn't mean one can't happen. You can have exogenous events that trigger them. I've had several of these in my career and in a period where there have been very few recessions. But I'll remind listeners that, we probably would have escaped a recession in 1990 had it not been for the Gulf War. And prior to the Lehman breakdown, there was a raging debate among economists in 2007 into 2008 as to whether or not we were even in recession. So doesn't mean that there's never a 0% likelihood. If you think there is, you're just underestimating the risk. But for all the things we can see, the conditions that are in place really don't suggest we're going to see one.
And whenever the economy is showing substandard growth, which it is right now, that means somebody's in recession. And there are, you mentioned housing, high-ticket consumer durables like housing, like RVs, like cars, have been in recession. You ask people in those industries, their business has been down for a few years. Trucking has been in recession for almost 3 years now. There are parts of the economy, from an industry point of view, that are clearly in recession, but others aren't. And it's that blending of businesses that are growing, those that are not, they're shrinking, that produces low growth. And you mentioned also by income category. This and it really started with that spike in inflation in 2020. 2022, the lower your income was, the less likely you were to be able to overcome that. So we started seeing this, you know, it's really a recession that kind of grew up from the bottom, from the lowest incomes, and it's kind of moving into the middle incomes right now. But there's still enough growth, particularly in purchasing ability at the higher end, to kind of keep us out. But it's been an unusual situation. And yeah, we think it more than likely that it won't cascade over into a full-blown recession. But it looks to me, you know, if interest rates can come down somewhat, you know, if we get mortgages in the fives, that'll do wonders for the for the housing sector, and which is a huge, even though it doesn't have a lot of stock market capitalization, it's a huge part of the economy.
Yeah, well,
would help a lot.
For majority of households, their home is their largest asset. And we've kind of been in this unusual situation where we've seen home equity build because a lot of people are sitting on low rate mortgages and they haven't been able to refinance. And that's actually been a blessing. You know, we've actually got people building home equity where in the past they would just continually cash it out, slowed the economy down.
Yep.
But it has made household balance sheets a lot stronger. Yeah.
It has taken a lot of supply off the market of existing homes. That's the problem, which is one of the reasons why we've had the slowdown in housing, even while housing prices have risen. You reduce supply and you don't reduce demand. Guess what? Prices go up. Home builders, you know, you'd think, well, that's a situation where they could step in. Well, it's not that easy. All kinds of reasons for that.
Okay. Third one. How much are blue chip companies participating in cryptocurrencies? Well, officially, there's only one dedicated cryptocurrency company in the S&P 500, and that's Coinbase. But there are crypto assets scattered across the corporate sector. You know, even BlackRock has about $100 billion of crypto in its balance sheet. Now, I think they're over a $3 trillion company. So it's not a lot, although, $100 billion is clearly nothing to sneeze at. What we're watching, or what I'm watching very carefully, however, is not crypto in broad terms, but the whole creation of the stablecoin universe, which I think is going to have significant ramifications for the whole payment industry. And I anticipate that not banks and private companies are going to start issuing their own stablecoins. And we could have almost a free-for-all situation with stablecoins, similar to what you saw in the free banking era after Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. Lots of various crypto stablecoins floating around the universe with different exchange rates. And we'll see how that plays out. But in terms of the large companies, there's clearly crypto. They're crypto curious, I think. They're looking at it. You've had an advent of small companies following MicroStrategy, or now Strategy's program of becoming crypto treasury companies. But, the S&P did not put Strategy in the index as many had anticipated. And I think some of that's concern about the business model.
Yeah, of the large companies, the question is blue chip companies participating. Answer is by and large no. Just about every financial company is doing some work on the stablecoin issue because the regulatory restrictions on that seem to be coming down. At least that's the indication that we've been getting from the administration. And so if you're a major bank, you've got to have some people in your corporate strategy department to at least looking at it and seeing what it's going to do. Even if we don't issue stable coins, what's it going to do to the environment that we're in? I think there's a lot yet to come here.
Yeah, stable coins could be as earth-shattering as the expansion of credit cards. You know, it just changes the whole payment rails. You know, you could easily see a large retailer issuing stable coins and then offering various incentives to use it on the site and maybe encouraging people other than the retailer to accept the coin with various incentives. So, there's an old line, there's nothing better than issuing your own money. It's just the trick is getting somebody to accept it. And, I think that there's clearly an incentive to do that. So not a lot now, but I think there'll be more to come. Question number four, what are our thoughts about President Trump's floated idea of changing quarterly reporting to semi-annual? This is one of those questions, Mark, that's similar to things that come up on every once in a while where I have absolutely no opinion. Mm-hmm. So this one's yours. So take it away.
Okay. Well, you know, the argument for this for years, and it's, we've never had an administration really float it, but we have had members of Congress and senators talk about this. And the argument is that lengthening the reporting period would reduce what I'll call short-term itis on the part of managers, company management, and investors, and focus them on longer-term timeframes instead of quarter-to-quarter. Well, we have an opportunity to test that by looking at Europe, where the vast majority of companies report semi-annually. And I don't see any evidence that it eliminates short-term itis. Either a company is focused on the long term or it isn't. If it's focused on the short term, the number, the frequency of reports is not going to help. And I've been skeptical of that argument for a long time. It would save money. That's one thing you can say. And I think that was part of the argument that the president made, was that issuing quarterly reports just is an expense. Honestly, though, going from quarterly to semi-annual, while it would, by definition, reduce some expenses, the expenses of being public are so extraordinary that I just don't think it makes a big enough difference.
Yeah, that's not going to solve the problem.
That is not going to solve the problem either. Yeah. So I'm kind of skeptical. Plus, you know, frankly, investors have been expecting quarterly reports, I mean, for about 70 years now. And so I think a lot of companies will continue to. There are foreign companies, European especially, who do a lot of business in the U.S., have a lot of investors in the U.S., and even though they don't have to, have been reporting quarterly for a while. And many companies, even if they don't report quarterly earnings, European companies, mm-hmm. will report quarterly sales mm-hmm. numbers, because investors don't want to wait 6 months to find out how things are going. So even if they say, hey, you don't have to do that anymore, I bet a lot of companies would just keep doing it. So I'm kind of skeptical of the whole thing.
Do you think that some companies may just say, you know, the president said every 6 months, it's not a requirement, we're only going to do every six? Could they do that? Or is there a legal requirement that they...
No, the SEC requires quarterly reporting. So, yeah. But as I was saying, if they change that to semi-annual is now the requirement, my guess is a number of companies would report
Something quarterly.
Yeah. When I got into the business, and granted, this was in the dark ages, but when I got into the industry and I started as an electric utility analyst, there were a lot of utilities that reported earnings monthly.
Oh, wow.
Even though they didn't have to. It was a bit frustrating for a young analyst because you had to keep up with that. I didn't issue monthly estimates, however, but it was kind of crazy. You know, every 4 weeks you had an earnings report. I think quarterly is a nice number, and I bet a lot of companies stick with it even if they change it.
And I would remind listeners that when Mark was referring to his coverage of utilities as a young analyst, electricity had not been around for very long. So
it was kind of a new thing.
It was a new thing. Yeah, you know. Mark knew Tesla. Tesla was a friend of his. And, you know, Bill, you're no Tesla.
Thomas Edison was a client
of yours.
Yeah, client I lost.
When they called it Edison Power, it was Thomas.
It was Tom. Yeah.
Last question. Any thoughts on Fed independence? Well, funny you should ask. I just finished two books on the very topic. One called Limitless by a Wall Street Journal reporter, and another called Fed Unbound. Both great books. Highly recommend both. This is, I think, as I finish these books, this is what I think the ultimate problem is. The Fed has gradually and then suddenly expanded its remit and powers. Its initial role was to ensure that there was enough liquidity in the system to prevent bank runs. Over the years, it also got mandates on unemployment and inflation, but ultimately you have central banks there because banking has an inherent flaw where it funds its lending with short-term runnable deposits. And so the central bank is there to prevent liquidity crises. Over the years, financial entities have emerged to avoid the regulatory and other costs involved with deposit making. So in the 50s, we had the emergence of the repo market. About a decade later, we had the emergence of the Eurodollar market. And then in the 70s, we had the emergence of money markets, all three of which are effectively engaged in deposit taking activities, but without the backstop of the Fed. Well, in 2008, we discovered that all of these were runnable. And so the Fed broadened its remit to protect money market funds, to protect euro dollars, and to protect the repo industry. And then in 2020, during the pandemic, it expanded it even further. It backstopped muni bonds, junk bonds, investment grade bonds. It did all sorts of balance sheet expansion. And what we've discovered is that the Fed has enormous power. In fact, you could argue that the Fed can put a floor on the price of any financial asset if it so desires. Now, there are restrictions to doing this, to exercise these powers. They're designed to be sort of one-off, and that you need five governors signing off and the Treasury Secretary approving it to do it. It's pretty obvious in crises that there's not a whole lot of pushback. And the trouble is, now that we know that these powers exist, if you're in the political class, every crisis then becomes a good excuse to engage in this. It's not inconceivable that if we had a stock market crash, that the Fed could come in and backstop stocks. And the argument would be that, you know, a stock market crash was triggering liquidity crises in other parts of the financial system. So given this kind of power, you're kind of staring down the barrel of one of two choices. Either you're going to say, going forward, we will no longer engage in these activities, flat out. You know, it's sort of like the scene in Young Frankenstein where the doctor goes in to the monster and says, whatever I say, don't open this door. And then, of course, then he goes in and pleads that he was only kidding. And Claire Bunker said, no, don't open that door. So that's one way the Fed could get its independence for sure. But the trouble is that then you're opening up the potential for a 1930s style debt deflation that I don't think anybody in the political class, or frankly anybody except maybe a few creditors, would want. The other is that they're going to continue to have this kind of power. The political system's going to get their mitts on it because, frankly, it's so powerful that they can't help but not. And so that's to me is really where the problem lies. And I don't really see an obvious decision. I guess in theory, you could say, well, we're going to put really high bars in place for the Fed to do whatever it's going to do again. But honestly, if you're in power and this something happens, you're going to make sure that you're going to cross that bar. And it's kind of like once you see this power, you can't unsee it. And I think what you're really looking at is that the loss of Fed independence. I don't see any other way around it. Fed independence is really important because in a world of fiat currency, we have pretty much made the argument that fiat currencies can be just as trustworthy as gold as long as you have an independent central bank with a clear inflation target. That's kind of the decision we've made. And once we kick one of those pillars out, then fiat becomes a little bit unhinged. And I think this is, if you're looking for the argument why gold is doing what it's doing, I think this is probably one of the arguments behind it.
You got around to the issue I was going to mention there. And that is, you know, Fed independence means a Fed that protects the dollar and protects treasuries values. And, you know, we used to have the dollar anchored to gold. President Nixon got us off that in 1971. And at the same time, he was beating up his Fed chair, not too different than what we've seen right now, to try and get him to do the right thing. So eventually we got a new one in. And we went through a couple of chairs, Burns and Miller in the 70s, who, you know, frankly, didn't defend the currencies very much. It kind of bent to political wills. And we saw inflation rise, treasury values fall, and gold go up. And it took Carter hiring Volcker, and Volcker came in and raised interest rates dramatically to protect both the dollar and the treasury markets in the long run. But it cost it's one of the things that cost Carter his presidency.
Oh, sure.
Most politicians, I think, after that, probably there wouldn't be too many who would make that decision.
No.
And I think that's one of the issues we've got to think about is that, you know, unless the Fed's going to stand up like that, like Volcker did, we're likely headed back to a period where the administration jawbones the Fed into getting it to do what it wants. And that's what gold is telling you is happening. It'll be interesting to see. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're headed there.
And I would agree. The one thing I've been mulling about is that there are two factors that were different. In the late 70s, early 80s, debt levels were much lower. And so Volcker could crater the debt markets by raising interest rates, and it was manageable. The other difference was we had much lower levels of income inequality. And there's a great line, you know, from F. Scott Fitzgerald, that the rich are different. And Hemingway was reported to have said in retort, that's because they have money. But the wealthy do react differently to inflation and currency debasement than less affluent households do. Less affluent households buy stuff, because if they don't buy it today, it'll be a higher price tomorrow. Affluent households usually don't have that problem. Yeah, they do, but they pretty much own a lot of stuff. So they're looking for inflation hedges. And what are the classic inflation hedges? Well, gold, cryptocurrency is probably one now, and equities. So you could end up in a situation unlike the 70s where we end up with asset inflation instead of just price inflation. And that would be a significant difference. Now, whether that's going to happen or not, who knows? But it's an outcome that we have to be cognizant of. You know, if you look at what's happened with stock markets in hyperinflating countries, Weimar Republic, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, their stock markets in local currency terms did great. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the things I will show on a regular basis is that Turkey was experiencing 80% inflation, and they still had a real return on their equity markets. Now, for dollar-based investors, it was not pretty, but for for lira-based investors, it was actually a good place to be, and we could see something quite similar.
You just touched on something we already talked about, and that is that in rising inflation, especially when it really takes off, is much harder on lower incomes than on higher incomes, and we've seen that have all kinds of repercussions, particularly politically. And you know, if this Fed has a real tall order, however, succession of many administrations have built the deficit and the debt load up to levels that we haven't seen too often in history. And it's a taller order today than we saw back in the 70s.
I would agree. Well, we've been at it for a while. I think it's a good time to wrap up here. As a reminder, if you want to submit a question, you can send it to mailbag@confluenceim.com. Today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll.